This audio is from the May 2010 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. You'll find more about the book fair, including more audio downloads, at www.wsm.ie/bookfair. This session was Israeli Apartheid, BDS and Grassroots Resistance in Palestine. The speaker is Freddie Hughes from the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign.
Hi, so we're welcome to this talk on Israeli Apartheid, BDS and Grassroots Resistance in Palestine. Speaking is Frida from the Irish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Frida will speak for about 15-20 minutes, and then we'll open up to the floor for questions and answers.
Okay, as Finn said, I'm Frida. I work for the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. I'm going to speak today, I mean obviously there's so many issues surrounding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, so to try and narrow it down to actually fit into this discussion, I want to talk first about Israeli apartheid and pose the question, is Israel's regime an apartheid regime? Then I want to talk a little bit about grassroots resistance to the occupation and to Zionism, and then to kind of finish that up by talking a little bit about the BDS movement, the boycott against the sanctions movement. So first of all, right, if we're going to talk about Israeli apartheid, we have to kind of look at the roots of where that began, which means going back to 1948 and the Nakba. The Nakba means catastrophe. It's an Arabic word, it means catastrophe. It happens, it's almost been written out of history, and this is consciously done within Israel, and particularly for Palestinians living within Israel. The Nakba is actually a word that is banned from textbooks. The Nakba resulted in 700,000 people being expelled from their land, and 160,000 people that remained then were living under a system of military rule, which is kind of the same system that people in the West Bank and Gaza live under today. So up until 1966, these people would have lived under a system of military rule. There were also present absentees, as they were called, under the Israeli regime, which means those people were forced to flee their homes, but they managed to remain within Israel, as in they didn't end up having to leave, go to Jordan, to Egypt, any other country. So they remained within Israel, but they were not allowed to return to their homes. About 270,000 of these internally displaced Palestinians today. Their lands, when this happened, were then settled by Jewish people in a conscious attempt to Judaicize the land. There is the Association for the Rights of Internally Displaced People in Israel, and this is a group that would still, to this day, fight for the rights of these people. I met them when I was out there. Their struggle is very, very different from the struggle of Palestinians within the West Bank or Gaza, and also very different from the struggles of the diaspora. I won't go into that in detail at the moment, purely because this talk could go on. Also, we have to look at housing and land law discrimination. There's around 250 Palestinian villages within Israel that have restrictions on building outwards. They are no longer allowed to expand at all. So this may have, you know, started with, you know, 100 or so people. As families expand, as people move in, whatever, they're not allowed to build out. So the buildings, they're only allowed to build up, which causes all sorts of sort of structural problems as well. I mean, you're looking at a house, a two-story house, built for foundations for a two-story house, has had to be built up rather than out in the meantime. Again, we recognise apartheid then in the right of return, or the lack of recognition of the right of return for Palestinians. Discrimination within Israel and in Palestine as well is very, very evident in the education system. Again, I'm not going to go too deeply into that because that could be a whole discussion on its own. And also within employment, where Palestinians are generally given the lower paid and the more menial jobs. Also, this is the word I always pronounce wrong, but the Israeli Trade Union Federation, which is the Histadrut. I got it right this time. I know we're putting in a couple of extra O's, right? Which, I mean, it does talk of being an inclusive trade union and a brotherhood and being an organisation of solidarity. However, it is a completely Zionist organisation, and for all its talk of this, it only began to accept Palestinians in 1959. They still don't enjoy full or equal rights. For example, Histadrut failed to take any action when Palestinian training guards were sacked en masse because they were seen as a security threat to the Israeli state. Israel did nothing in this situation. They didn't stand up for their Palestinian workers at all. So no matter what the line that might be put out, they are an explicitly Zionist organisation and cannot, on that basis, be seen to represent the rights of Palestinians who are possibly members. Okay, yes, Palestinians living within Israel can vote, but there has never been any Palestinian party that was represented in government. There are some Palestinian parties who have Knesset seats, However, to be explicitly anti-Zionist within the Knesset is actually illegal. So again, how much representation does the Palestinian voice within Israel actually have? Okay, now this is the kind of bit of the... Okay, according to the US State Department country report on human rights practices for Israel and the occupied territories, the Israeli government has done, and this is quote, little to reduce institutional, legal, societal discrimination against the country's Arab citizens. So again, this is not just my word, this is not just coming from Palestinians living within Israel, this is widely reported, but again, nothing is done about it. Okay, so also, I mean, when we look at the increase of repression of Palestinian activists and also anti-Zionist Israeli activists, or even left-wing Israeli activists, a good example of this would be like Amir Makhoul, who was part of the coalition of Palestinian NGOs, and Omar Saeed, who this week were both charged after extensive torture and detention. They were charged with spying for Hezbollah. I mean, they eventually confessed to this under torture. Their lawyers are now trying to take a case against the fact they were tortured as well. We look at Azmi Bashara from the Ballad Party and crackdowns on groups such as Adala, who are the legal centre for Arab minorities within Israel, and also major crackdowns on Israeli anti-Zionist groups like Anarchists Against the Wall, with mass arrests of people who actually come out and protest within Israel or move into the West Bank. This, again, clearly shows obvious attempts at repression and obvious apartheid within the Israeli state. And that's only talking about Israel. Now if we look at the West Bank and Gaza, in 1967, the West Bank, Gaza and the Golan Heights were occupied. They became subject to military rule, discrimination, repression and economic strangulation. Okay, what I'm going to talk about in the next section applies mainly to the West Bank, because in 2005, Israel technically disengaged from Gaza, so different rules now apply. This obviously doesn't mean that the people of Gaza have an easier time, because Israel has disengaged. They actually have it much worse. All we have to do is look at the bombardment in winter 2008-2009, the killing of almost 1,500 people, the fact that 80,000 people are still internally displaced within Gaza, and are entirely dependent on humanitarian food aid to this day, over a year after this happened, shows that the situation within Gaza is almost has to be taken separately from the Palestinian question in some ways, because it is very, very specific to that region. I mean, also, when you look at Gaza, it's been described widely as the world's largest open-air prison. And you have to kind of draw the analogy between an actual prison and you say, okay, just because 90% of prisoners, live in the they live in the prison where they are, it certainly doesn't show that they have any control over it. The same would really obviously apply for Gaza. And just because Israel has disengaged, it certainly hasn't made life any easier at all. Okay, at this point, I want to just pass around a couple of maps. Unfortunately, I've only got two of them. This is just to kind of show the, I suppose, the history, in a way, of the occupation. You've got the, what would have been Palestine here, the land of Palestine, and then you look, I'll pass them around if you have a look. But you look at 1947 here, the white part of the occupied area is where Israel started to form. And then you see the depletion and depletion. This last map I have here is 2000. When we look at the 2007 to 2010 map, you're looking at even more division here. And basically, you're looking at three separate green areas which are all completely blocked off. But that's within the West Bank, which is actually Palestinian. But we'll talk more about that now. I'm going to pass them around just so people want to have a better look. They're pretty small, so again, kind of hard to see. So, I suppose what's happening within the West Bank, when you look at the land grab and why that's happening, it's really, a lot of it is down to settlements. When I went to Palestine and Israel in 2008, I was shocked by the settlements. For years, I'd read about them. I basically went over expecting kind of caravan parks, basically, for some reason. And when I got there, I realised these are big towns with, you know, a lot of corporate investment, chain stores, franchise restaurants, university branches. They're big, they're ugly, but very, very plush, I suppose. You're looking at condos, penthouses, big apartment blocks. It's absolutely unreal. These are big, big towns, and they are all over the West Bank, particularly around Jerusalem as well. I mean, it's disgusting. The other thing is they tend to take the best land, the most beautiful land, the most fertile land, and the settlements always seem to rob the top of hills. You know, the best land always is chosen for the settlements. There's also the fact that settlers are only subject to civil law, although they are actually illegally in Palestine, in the West Bank, under international law, they are subject to civil law, Israeli civil law, whereas Palestinians living within the West Bank and Gaza are subject to military law. Again, serious issues here, given that the presence of settlers is illegal under international law. They're also given a carte blanche to carry arms, to kill and hurt Palestinians as they see fit. There's very, very few prosecutions. They're often protected and aided by the Israeli Defence Forces. I've seen this firsthand. It's really bizarre. I mean, there are people, there's so many people in there in Human Rights Watch, but at the end of the day, you can watch, you can witness, you can report all you want. The powers that be aren't going to do anything. It continues unabated. Another issue is the apartheid road system, which again is very, very strange. There's certain roads that just within the West Bank, I'm talking about, not within Israel, but within the West Bank, Palestinian territory, there's certain roads which Palestinians can't use. And of course, they're the best roads. The Palestinians have to have white number plates on their cars, and Israelis have yellow. And if you're caught driving down the wrong road with your white number plate, you can be taken over and arrested. Obviously, the checkpoints and closures cause huge disruption to people's lives. You see people queuing from 5 a.m. to get to work. They often won't get through the checkpoint that they go through 4 out of the 5 days of the week. Ambulances are often not allowed through. You hear people, you know, dying in childbirth, dying for want of getting to a hospital on time, people giving birth at checkpoints, all sorts of ridiculous medical situations that could easily be avoided. And also, oftentimes, the security manning the checkpoints are very, very young, new conscripts. Often these kids are like, you know, they could be sort of 17, 18-year-olds, and on a whim, they can decide not to let an ambulance through, just, you know, just because. Soldiers often board buses with guns. I was quite hungover on a bus in Palestine, rooting in my handbag, and got clocked in the head by the end of the gun. Good Jesus Christ! And that's commonplace. I mean, that wasn't done, you know, to get me to wake up, that was just the guy who was swishing down the bus. This is standard common practice as well. Again, I won't go into it in detail, but when I went to Nablus, I was in a taxi, totally given the runaround, sent to 3 different checkpoints, turned away from all of them. Oddly enough, at one because of the Irish passport, and eventually had to like go a crazy, mad route over the hills and basically sneak in the back way, and had come back out the same way as well, which was really difficult in the middle of the night. But yeah, I mean, the checkpoints are just—it's just a purposeful hindrance. I mean, if you're in any way into punctuality, forget about it in Palestine. Now, the wall, East Jerusalem, and the Bantustanization of the West Bank are 3 of the really kind of pertinent issues, which I won't go on at length about, but. The wall would be one of the most obvious indicators of Israel's colonial plans. It doesn't follow the standardised or the accepted occupied territories borders. It cuts through Palestinian land, and as I said, often through the most fertile and beautiful land, giving this land then onto the settlers. It divides lives, it divides families, it divides friends, and it's a constant visual reminder of oppression. It's an ugly, disgusting big wall, and oftentimes I think it is put there as a really visual, look what we're doing to you here. I'll a couple of pictures here, I'll send them in. East Jerusalem then was illegally annexed in 1967. And Palestinians there resist by refusing to accept Israeli citizenship. Of course, this leaves them in a very awkward position because East Jerusalem is now disputed as to whether it's Israel or the West Bank. Okay? There's severe discrimination in social provision for Palestinian neighbourhoods. Building permits are almost impossible to get in East Jerusalem. Large, huge amounts of house demolitions, and you probably will have heard about quite a lot of resistance to that. And this is all part of a conscious plan to create a Jewish majority in East Jerusalem. Okay, so at the present time, it does seem to be Israel's political and demographic objection to create 4 South African-style Bantustans, basically 3 disconnected, nominally Palestinian-controlled enclaves surrounded by walls and checkpoints in the West Bank, and then another one, which is the open-air prison that is Gaza. The ultimate objective then seemingly being to further squeeze these areas until people start to leave. Other issues then within the West Bank and Gaza is water. Israel steals Palestinian water, and the Palestinian water supply then, that sounded really silly, they steal Palestinian water, but they actually do, from Palestinian aquifers, often given great huge water supplies then to the settlements. Palestinian water supply is often irregular and scarcely enough for basic needs, in contrast with the settlements, which in fact use a ridiculous amount of water per capita. You're looking at swimming pools, oftentimes people turn on the taps and can to get water while looking across at swimming pools in the settlement on what was their land maybe 5 years or less before. And then another really obvious indicator of apartheid is when you look at what Palestinians in detention suffer. Never mind why they've been detained. Again, prisoners' issues for a whole other talk. But basically, Palestinians in detention are subject daily to mistreatment and are often held in cells with Israeli criminal prisoners. There's regular body searches, which are very, very briefly performed at that. Sexual harassment is really, really common, particularly for women prisoners. The right to elect a representative for their collective demands is not recognised. Solitary confinement is often used as punishment, and unjustly so. They are prohibited from going outside regularly. Confiscation of personal belongings is common. Attacks by beatings and tear gas being thrown into the cells is a really common occurrence, and it's really, really difficult to deal with. So I suppose to conclude the section on apartheid, and probably should be concluding the full section at this stage, but just to conclude the section on apartheid, I kind of want to pose the question, which is kind of rhetorical, is the comparison between Israeli apartheid and South African apartheid fair, and is it necessary? I would say that it is fair. It doesn't mean that it's the same. In fact, some leading South African anti-apartheid activists have said that what Israel visits upon Palestinians is far worse than anything the South African government ever does to black South Africans. Again, this is probably something for discussion later on. Even if it's not a fair comparison, which I do think it is, but if people think it's not, it can be justified to call Israeli apartheid into an apartheid state on its own terms. Basically, if we look at the legal definitions of apartheid, this can kind of give us the framework for that. There are two legal definitions. One is the 1973 UN General Assembly. It's quite long. To be honest, if you wanted to Google that one, have a look at it yourself, that would probably be the best thing. For the purpose of this, and for the purpose of keeping it short, I'm just going to quote the International Criminal Court's 1998 definition, which describes apartheid as inhumane acts committed in the context of an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another racial group, and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. And it also lists apartheid as a crime against humanity. When we look at that kind of framework for apartheid, we can say that yes, Israel's actions are both consciously apartheid and completely, that apartheid is completely inherent to the entire Zionist regime. So at this point, again, like I said, we can kind of open it up to questions in the end, but I just want to talk about resistance to Zionism, to the occupation, to the wall, and I'll try and keep it as brief as I can. Basically, down through the years, Palestinians have always resisted apartheid in many ways, and in one way we could say that the mere fact that Palestinians still exist as a people is testament to their ongoing resistance. The first Intifada in 1987 saw mass civil disobedience uprising. It was mostly non-violent resistance, but not entirely. Some good examples of this that kind of showed a turning point and certainly more of a push towards civil disobedience would be the tax strikes in Beit Sahur, which is an area just outside Bethlehem, and then which was really, really effective, actually, and they were nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize or something for it. They didn't get it, but again, internationally, this became a huge phenomenon. Also, mass mobilisations and demonstrations. Unfortunately, this sort of gradually fizzled out by 1992. The PLO, who at first had no control over the popular uprising, eventually co-opted it, and anger in Palestinian society formed the basis for the failed Oslo negotiations. A direct consequence then of this failure was the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September 2000. The Second Intifada was far more violent. It's a word I cannot say without my Dublin 15 accent coming out, but it was very violent to us. But the suicide bombing formed the contextual framework for Western media coverage of the Second Intifada. But there were many creative, non-violent, direct action initiatives taking place at grassroots level. The ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, rose to prominence during this period for the confrontational approach to the Israeli military in attempting to protect civilians and their houses. In 2003, the first popular committee was formed in the village of Budrus, where villagers literally lay down in front of bulldozers to prevent the apartheid wall being built through their land. Although ultimately this was an unsuccessful action, it did lay the template for the formation of many similar popular committees throughout the West Bank. The popular committees take non-violent direct action as an inherent principle. Some of the more famous popular committees then will be Nilayin, Nabi Saleh, Sheikh Jarrah, and then the one I'm most familiar with, and we'll talk a little bit now, is Bilin. A popular committee is basically a coming together of individuals from diverse political backgrounds would agreed upon common goals, which generally are non-violent resistance against the building of the apartheid wall and colonial settlements, the theft of their land or the demolition of houses. This method of struggle has become increasingly effective, especially with regard to international media coverage, so much so that it has been adopted nominally, at any rate, by the Palestinian Authority recently. So I said I was going to talk a little bit more about Baleen. Baleen started coordinated popular resistance around 2005, and actually Kev is going to pass around a few pictures of the demonstrations in Baleen and also some pictures of the settlement, which has been built in. The breaking of the curfew in September 2005 showed the strength of people power and non-violent direct action. The village had been put under curfew and they came out in this. It was basically like a Palestinian retail streets demonstration. It was brilliant. It was musical, it was fun, and it really showed the strength of direct action. Since 2005, they've held weekly Friday demonstrations, which are organised by the Popular Committee in conjunction with Anarchists Against the Wall, which are an Israeli group, and the ISM. These demonstrations then have gained popular support from the international solidarity movements worldwide, and they always have a really strong international presence on them. The form these protests take differ, and it's always very, very creative, but direct action is very regularly used as a tactic. This was something I wanted to show you, a short kind of video clip of some of the direct actions that have taken place out there, but they are really, really creative. One I'd like to talk about briefly is a situation where a number of ISM activists, Anarchists Against the Wall, and Palestinians from Baleen built a cage. It was actually a big metal cage. They brought it down and plonked it right beside the wall. As you'll see from the pictures, the wall in Baleen is actually a series of two very high fences. The reason the wall has not been built in concrete at this stage is because of the resistance. It remains two fences, right? So the activists went up two pointers at the wall, where the Israeli military are always stationed on the opposite side of it. They plonked this huge cage down, they got into it and they chained themselves to the cage. Of course, the soldiers couldn't stand for this, and after a point they eventually brought out a big JCB, a big digger, to pull apart the cage. They did this while the activists were still inside, and then physically dragged them out across the ground and had them arrested immediately. So although they were arrested and the cage dismantled, the visual image of the IDF dismantling this cage was highly ironic, given that it really showed how Palestine, like what the action tried to prove is that Palestine has been turned into an open-air prison, and all of a sudden you have the IDF actually dismantling that themselves. There's been other instances where they've made huge paper mache models of the settlement, which has been built just across from it, carried it up to the wall, broken through one section of fence and been between the two bits of fence, which is, again, I'll talk a bit more about that. That always spurns a disproportionate reaction from the military. But they took the mock settlement up there, and the soldiers got so annoyed that eventually they smashed up the settlement. Again, a video clip I was hoping to show you. IDF members smashing up a model of the settlement they're there to protect. Brilliant. But anyway, other actions include people have U-locked themselves, their arms like this around, say this is one of the fence cones, just tear down some of the chicken wire, you lock yourself on like this, you're stuck there, and you are entirely at the mercy of the IDF. But generally, if internationals do these direct actions, they have a little bit more protection because they're internationals. And this was a really, really brave action that I think is one of the few things I wouldn't do. About four or five people necklocked themselves to a piece of ground that had been stolen and was going to be used to construct something else in the settlements. They lay on the ground with their, basically lying in a kind of a metal piece of tubing, had another piece of metal put down with it, just a piece cut out for your neck, and were actually necklocked onto the ground. And they stayed there until the IDF eventually couldn't take anymore. There was a demonstration formed around them. The IDF got really, really thick, eventually got the demonstrators away, started shooting at them, whatever, and had to actually physically remove these people. Again, done with quite a lot of aggression, but if they're seen to, break one of their necks, there's going to be a huge international outcry over it. So again, better if internationals take on some of these direct actions. Other activists encased their bodies in huge oil drums and basically standing there like the Michelin Man, arms and legs stuck out like this and your head at the top, and I think it was called Heads Under the Sun. They stood there in the blazing sun with each barrel chained together, and then a lot of the Palestinians from Baleen brought up signs that said stop the wall, and actually they made a wall in front of the wall, and eventually the soldiers were getting really, really thick with them and they started pushing them over. So you had these six people in barrels kind of going woo, and then woo back the way again, and eventually they pushed them to the ground and hammered the barrels off and arrested them all again. But these direct actions are actually really, really effective. because of the international media attention they get, and also it shows the ongoing resistance. This has gone on for 5 years, and it has worked. The IDF reacts completely disproportionately every week. They fire tear gas and rubber-coated bullets. Sometimes they fire, this is a really disgusting phenomenon, it happens a lot in Nilayn, they fire sewage water, like basically toilet water, all over the protesters. I was pretty lucky that never happened to me, but I've heard a lot of people it has happened to, and it's disgusting. Unfortunately, a good friend of mine and a few other people here, Bassam Abu-Rama, was shot in the chest just over a year ago with a tear gas canister. I think there's a picture of him there. And it was high impact, close range, shot in the chest, he died immediately. About 4 months before that, I had been out protesting with Bassam and his cousin Abdallah Abu-Rama, who's now in prison. He was one of the most charismatic protesters on the on these rallies I was singled out because of his charisma and his ability to organise and mobilise. Abdallah has been arrested a couple of months after his cousin Bassam was killed. When I was there, we went between the two fences and we had a sit-down protest. We weren't very creative that week. But we sat there for a damn long time, it was about 20 of us, and when they started throwing the tear gas in, we wouldn't move. We just had our scarves up and glasses on or whatever, and it wouldn't move, and then they started throwing it in. The other side still wouldn't move, and then they started shooting at us. And to be honest, if it wasn't for Bassam and Abdallah, I quite possibly could have a bullet in the shoulder at this stage, because they're really good. They get the internationals out, because they're doing it every week. They make sure everybody's all right. They're the last people there. They just, you know what I mean? They really keep an eye on everything. They keep everything ticking over. The Israelis notice these people, single them out, and get rid of them in whatever way. Now, they didn't. I don't think the intention was to kill Bassam. But when you shot fire and tear gas at people's chests at close range, what do you expect? Another international activist, Tristan Anderson, was shot in the head with a tear gas canister in March of last year. And he's lost most of his brain function because of that and remains in hospital to this day. Many others have been badly injured and unfairly arrested for taking part in demonstrations and direct actions in Berlin, including an Irish kind of independent journalist who's out there. He's a, would we call him an independent journalist? A lot of people will know Tommy Donovan.
Indie media man.
Indie media man, exactly. He's a legend. He's a real legend. A great guy for direct action and grassroots mobilisation. And he videos everything wherever he goes. He was arrested, and whatever they did to him, when they took his gas mask off, he actually lost part of his ear 2 weeks ago while videoing a demonstration. The effectiveness of non-violent direct action can be judged by the increasing amount of repression meted out to activists, their families, and internationals by the Israeli state. I must stress that it's not just to the activists themselves. Families are subject to night raids and really, really awful intimidation of children and that, which again is another day's discussion. I don't really have time to go into it either, but there is quite a lot of resistance amongst Palestinian citizens of Israel, and as I said before, they are very heavily repressed, and it is more difficult to kind of carry a direct action resistance within there. Resistance art is also a big thing in the West Bank. You look at art on the wall and also in disputed areas like playgrounds and areas like this that are attempted to be taken over by settlers. Graffiti is big over there. Then, of course, we have to talk a little bit about non-violent resistance in Gaza. Obviously, I'm just focusing on non-violent resistance here at the moment. Similar initiatives to the Berlin protests and the West Bank protests exist in Gaza, where the actions are largely agriculturally based. Basically, the people resisting are trying to farm their own land, but their land has been designated as a buffer zone by the Israeli state because it's near the Israeli-Gaza border. So similarly, international activists are regularly on these protests as kind of protection, really. It doesn't stop people from being shot and arrested, again, both internationals and Palestinians. But I have to stress the presence of internationals there does help. And also, a lot of international activists will be regular passengers on Gazan fishing boats, which are subject to unjust buffer zones at sea. This is something maybe in the questions and answers kind of bit that we do, we can talk about a bit more, but most of you will be aware of the flotilla to Gaza. It's called the Freedom Flotilla. That's currently en route to Gaza from Cyprus. Also why I'm slightly unprepared with this, because I've been writing feckin' press releases on it non-stop. That would be a really obvious example of grassroots resistance to the siege. It's an attempt to break the siege of Gaza by sending what was 9, unfortunately 2 ships have been damaged, now 7 ships into Gaza to break the blockade. Again, I can maybe talk about that and flesh it out a little bit if people want me to later on. Now I just want to kind of finish up this talk by talking about the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, which is something that is a very, very effective way of resisting, and it's a way that people can resist from their home country. If you don't have to be Palestinian, you don't have to be an international activist in Palestine, this is a way of resisting and trying to bring about a much more kind of fair situation for Palestinians, and you can do it from home. The call for boycott, divestment and sanctions came from Palestinian civil society in 2005. And there's also been calls for a boycott from within, so from Israeli civil society. Again, we're looking at movements like Anarchists Against the Wall, anti-Zionist NGOs, and a lot of the sort of Palestinian citizens of Israel, their parties, their organisations, that kind of thing. But we are actually hearing quite a lot of calls for boycott from within, from Israeli society. I did speak to a young, brilliant activist from Anarchists Against the Wall about this. I mean, I speak about boycott from within to every bloody Israeli I meet, because I know there's quite a lot of left-wing opposition to the boycott. And this is something that, you know, we've dealt with at branch level in Maynooth, certainly get a lot of it, and you often deal with it at public meetings as well. And I've spoken to so many people about this. I said, you know, what is the line that Israelis who promote the boycott give to fellow Israelis to convince them that this? Because it's a growing movement, there's a growing call from within Israel. No one's ever given me a succinct answer, except for this 19-year-old absolute legend of a grassroots activist called Sahar Verdi. And she said, look at it this way, right? Israel does not want to be ostracised. And the economic boycott coming from the international community, from people all around the world, will not economically hurt Israel before Israel does something about it. Before it ever hurts the working class, Israeli government, Israeli organisations, Israeli companies will feel the pain, will feel the burn of being ostracised and having the finger pointed at them by the international community. They will react before it ever hurts our workers. And this is coming from a girl who's obviously working class herself. Again, boycott, divestment and sanctions, it's kind of there's various different issues within that. Divestment is something, again, we can talk about maybe in the questions and answers session. In the Irish context, I just want to kind of flesh out a little bit about what I work with, the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, right? And we've kind of been at the forefront of the BDS movement since the call went out in 2005. So I just want to flesh out a little bit about what that involves, and then I'll leave it at that, right? Because I could bloody talk for Ireland and Palestine, but anyway. I suppose the targets for the boycott would be things like food imports, the Israeli diamond industry, which is huge, and it represents a huge part of their GDP every year. Veolia, the company who run the Lewis, would be a target for divestment because they are also involved in running the settler-only tram lines, which go through the West Bank, as I spoke about before. Settler-only roads, there are also settler-only tram lines, so no Palestinian can use them. CRH, Cement Roadstone Holdings, the biggest Irish producer of cement, and one of the biggest international producers of cement, has the biggest share in the cement company that produces the cement that builds the wall. At the moment, we have a huge campaign around CRH in trying to get them to divest from that particular project. I can't say it's worked, we can't claim a victory on it yet, but it is working. What a number of people within the IPSC did was they actually bought shares, like one share each or whatever, in CRH, and went in and during the AGM stood up repeatedly and asked questions, made points, objected to things that were being said. It was a really effective action. We also produced an alternative annual report from CRH, which looks like it probably is their annual report, but it's full of the facts about what their investment in the West Bank is actually doing, what it's causing, and the life on the ground for Palestinians. So again, very, very effective campaign. And again, maybe we can talk about that a bit more later if people want to. The Irish Defence Forces have a contract with buying military gear and bullets off the Israelis. We're working on that at the moment with kind of political lobby work. In terms of victories, the Irish Lewis drivers refused to train Israeli drivers a couple of years back because of the involvement in the settler-only tram lines. Three city councils, Sligo, Galway and Dublin, have passed motions in favour of divestment from Veolia, because Veolia not only run the Lewis but also water and waste management services. And these motions have been passed in three councils. There's been a sustained campaign of kind of cultural boycott. Now again, this is a kind of a tricky one. We're not talking about boycotting every Israeli. We're talking about, you know, if somebody is coming over here and they're state funded, we would recommend, you know, a cultural boycott. But also of contacting Irish or international, particularly politically aware musicians, performers, etc., who are going to play in Israel. Again, this is one that often comes up for debate, so I'm expecting a little bit of debate about it after. But in terms of some victories, U2 eventually, whatever we may think of U2, eventually did agree to to cancel their tour date in Israel 2 years ago. An Irish theatre group recently cancelled in the last couple of weeks. A very recent one, which ourselves and the various solidarity movements in England worked on, was the Gil Scott Heron gig. And luckily, at the last minute, he actually did cancel, which was brilliant. And Carlos Santana has just cancelled his gig in Israel, as has Elvis Costello. And all on the grounds of, you know, a sustained campaign of cultural boycott. Okay, again, we're looking at, compared to our EU counterparts, the Irish government has a relatively pro-Palestinian stance. But, you know, we have kind of chipped away since 2001, since the IPSC was formed, with political lobby work, but also with grassroots mobilisations. And we do feel that we have kind of gradually chipped them into at least making stronger statements. But that, you know, that's not enough. We continue to lobby our government on various issues, like some of the ones that I have outlined. Also, we're looking at the Euromed agreement and the relations our government actually has with the Israeli state and with the Israeli ambassador here. So we plan to kind of continue our political lobbying work, but also we have a very two-pronged approach to activism and grassroots activism. And building support from people and civil society in Ireland is really the only way it can go. You have to have the two prongs. If you do one in favour of the other, with an issue like Palestine, it's not a home-based issue, you will not mobilise people. And media then, I mean, as I said earlier on in Andrew's discussion, when the media aren't on your side, you have to create your own media. So we lash out, we have a media team, we lash out press releases. We bombard every bloody media outlet, all the mainstream media outlets in this country with them. But we also create our own media electronically, and a lot of this then goes a long way for international solidarity. So I'm going to leave it at that, and if people want to ask questions, can work away.
Maybe we'll just take a round of questions. We've got about 20 minutes, so if people want to keep contributions relatively brief and free, they can come back at the end. So, yourself first.
Just when you were talking about the comparison between Israel and South Africa, I just remembered I was listening to the radio there. There was an interview with one of the drone strikers who refused to handle any goods because they're apartheid products during the South African apartheid regime. And she said that a year into that strike, there had been at least one branch of the anti-apartheid movement in every county in the country, and I was wondering why you haven't seen that kind of mobilisation on this issue, and whether that's something to do with the disparity between media reporting and the actual reality of apartheid.
Anybody else?
Could I just ask, maybe to elaborate a bit on Zionism, and actually what is the motivation, what do they hope to achieve in that case?
I can't quote it offhand, but I heard some statement from the IDF the other day about the flotilla going into Gaza at the moment. I think they allege something about terrorist states and the human rights people on board. And does it look like there's some sort of a confrontation that could end up going down very badly?
Okay, the last question, I can talk on it. Well, I'll start with the other two. In terms of the sort of mobilisations that did happen in reaction to South African apartheid and were extremely effective, that's obviously where we want to go with the boycott. At the moment, because we are we're a political organisation, we're not an NGO, we're not affiliated to any union or anything like that. We're just an independent organisation, and we have to work with our members on mobilisation boycott actions on the street. We do liaise with trade unions, and we have been pushing and pushing and pushing for individual unions or branches to direct their workers, or to allow provision for their workers not to handle Israeli goods. Unfortunately, nobody has acted on this yet. ICTU have been quite strong on the boycott in that they sent a delegation to Palestine and Israel a couple of years ago, then came back and wrote a really comprehensive report, passed a boycott motion at the conference, and very recently, like last month, held a big conference in Dublin Castle on boycott. And, well, basically on Israel-Palestine, but looking for the issue of boycott there as well. We're hoping that with that, and with the kind of growing, slow but hopefully steady push within the trade unions towards acting on the ICTU boycott motion, we will start to see a situation where workers are allowed to take that stance and refuse to handle Israeli goods. At the moment, we haven't seen it yet. The Lewis workers refusing to train the Israeli staff would be kind of the closest coordinated action like that, but yeah, that would be the hope. But at the moment, in terms of actual boycott actions themselves, we tend to organise them. They tend to be either boycott direct actions or leafleting and awareness raising outside outlets that are selling Israeli goods. So I hope that's kind of covered that one. Zionism, right, okay, this is a big one, but I'll try and answer it kind of, yeah, there'll be a smiling face there going, oh god, you've been here all day, but, and that's my fault, not yours. Zionism is basically, could be termed as a Judaization of Israel-Palestine, but it's not just about that, it's a colonial project, it gives its excuse is the Judaization of the land, that this is the Jewish homeland, it should be populated by the Jewish people, everybody who is Jewish has an automatic right to claim Israeli citizenship, and that is the case. However, it's not just about Jewish people returning to their homeland. There is always this false dichotomy drawn up in the media and by a lot of Zionists and sometimes Islamists as well, that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is about Islam against Judaism, and that is totally not true. Zionism is, at its heart, a colonial project. If we look back at, you know, pre-1948 plans from various Zionists who were involved in the formation of the state, we look at plans that they had, which was to take an awful lot more land than they actually have. Lebanon, Syria and parts of Jordan were part of this colonial project. Ben-Gurion himself wrote about these. Sometimes reading the words of Ben-Gurion re-quoting them are some of the best things to actually argue against the Zionist wish, because it's there in their own, you know, their own guiding principles is, yeah, it's a colonial project. There is no two ways about that. But it's one that at its heart uses the religion of a particular people to mobilise, to unite and to excuse a lot of its behaviour. Zionism then, I mean, a slogan you'd often hear chanted on marches is Zionism is racism or Zionism is apartheid. And it is, I mean, it is true. It's very clearly an obvious system where Palestinians, and even, when you look at inequality and the class system within Israel, for Jewish people themselves, there's quite a lot of inequality there. But then when you look at where Palestinians within Israel and then Palestinians in the occupied territory are beyond that, it's actually like a substrata. They're treated entirely like subhumans. So, and I don't mean the punk band, but Zionism is essentially a colonial project based loosely around, based in their words around Judaism, but there's a lot more to it than that. I hope that's kind of covered that. And then in the flotilla, in the middle of the talk, just got a text there about the flotilla, which is currently, let's give a background first of all. 9 ships from various parts of the world decided that they were going to leave from Cyprus, roughly, to travel to Gaza to deliver much needed aid. On board these ships are roughly 800 activists. Among them are politicians, TDs from Ireland and a senator from Ireland, MEPs, people from various other countries as well, Nobel Peace laureates, media people, doctors, lawyers, and a huge number of activists. Also a lot of Palestinians who've never been able to return, maybe have never actually been to Gaza, although their families were there, were from there, they've been expelled from their own land, and quite a few Israeli activists as well. The ships and the flotilla itself are largely being run by IHH, which is a Turkish company, and the Free Gaza Movement, who many of you will be aware of. They're very much a grassroots organisation who have sent boats in and out of Gaza on 8 separate occasions, not always successful. They've had their boats rammed in the past, they've had their activists arrested and sent to Israeli detention centres. They've come under quite a lot of threat. They had to be rescued by the Lebanese Coast Guard after being rammed late last year. So at the moment, the flotilla ended up 1 boat left from Turkey, 2 from Greece, to link up with the rest of the boats in Cyprus. Israel, in the meantime, went around meeting with representatives from all the different governments who had people on board and actively involved in the flotilla, none of which bowed to pressure, which the pressure being, you know, tell your activists not to go, we're not going to let them in. None of the governments, including the Irish government, bowed to that pressure, except for the Cypriots yesterday. Unfortunately, the Cypriots I'm sure a lot more pressure was applied because a number of the boats are waiting in Cyprus to join the flotilla. Also, the media centre for the Free Gaza Movement is in Cyprus. A lot of the land team, the on-the-ground activists, are in Cyprus. So the crackdown is happening there at the moment as we speak. Yesterday, the boats all converged near Cypriot water to pick up the other activists. They weren't allowed to enter Cypriot water. They were flanked by Cypriot police helicopters and videoed. One of the boats started letting on water and it had to offload its passengers at sea, but then luckily was allowed into Cypriot port to get repairs. If it hadn't been, that would have been a breach of international law, so I think that's why eventually it was let in. Second boat, which a lot of the Irish activists on, eventually kind of came up with a plan to go around to the Turkish side of Cyprus to land there and try and allow an awful lot of the, to be honest, a lot of people on the ground in Cyprus were the kind of politicians, the famous high-profile types that would actually probably guarantee more safe passage for the flotilla than the standard grassroots activists like ourselves. So again, very conscious efforts on the part of the Israeli government. They went around to the northern side, huge diplomatic issues, because the last thing the Cypriots want is for something to kick off between the north and the south. Last I heard, Osnoddy, Chris Andrews and Mark Daly, who were all out there from Ireland, were, after trying on four separate attempts to board the boats, and each time had been, you know, physically pushed back by the cops and told there was no way they could board. At the moment, what we've just been told there, that they are about to cast off to rejoin the flotilla. Permission was granted to leave Famagusta, which is where they were. They're waiting for Italian and Swedish MPs to board, and they have an EU statement demand. Okay, all right. Has the EU made a statement or asking for safe passage? I don't know the answer to that. So that's where they're at the moment. There are two ships down because the two ships that left from Crete had some damage. There is definitely talk. I mean, the Israelis in the last few days have had a huge PR battle against the flotilla, but also have already built a detention camp in Ashdod, which is a southern Israeli port. They have basically committed to taking the flotilla by force if necessary, and that's a quote, and rerouting it to Ashdod. They said they will board the boats, they will physically search the activists, all 800 of them, on board, and they're going to bring dogs on as well. If they find anything that they deem to be a weapon or a terrorist threat, they will then arrest everybody on board. If they don't think there's any terrorist threat, which at the moment, that's part of the PR battle, is they're saying that there's terrorists on board the ships. But they said that if they feel that there is a terrorist threat to their forces, they'll open fire on the flotilla. If they feel there isn't a terrorist threat on their forces, they will, regardless, reroute the boats, all, what, seven of them now, to Ashdod, offload everybody. All Israeli activists will be arrested on the spot. Palestinians are going to be taken away and questioned by the secret police. We don't know what's going to happen after that. And all other internationals will be immediately detained, given the option of immediate deportation. And if they resist that, they will also be arrested, along with the Israeli activists. As some of the Irish activists I've spoken to have said, they're going to resist deportation. It's happened before, when you know, a couple of months back as well. So it's not looking good, but we'll have to see. I mean, we just have to wait and see. This is why we keep ending up getting text messages and all this at 5 o'clock in the morning, having to get up writing press releases, because things are changing, not even from day to day, but from hour to hour. And we just really have to wait and see what happens on that one. So.
Just make 2 points about questions that have already been asked. One was about the terrorists, so-called, on the flotilla. The IHH, which is a Turkish Islamic human rights organisation, actually banned in Israel as a security threat. So, I mean, technically what the Israelis are saying is these guys are a security threat because we defined them as a security threat. You know what I mean? It's not like there's boys with rock launchers on these things or whatever. The second point is about the comparison with the South African anti-apartheid movement in this country. And when the Mary Manning and those started the strike in the 1980s, sometime in the mid-1980s, you have to remember that the anti-apartheid movement in this country had already been going for a good 15, 20 years, right? I mean, it was building up all the time. And any anti-apartheid activist I've talked to from back in the day has said that we've done more in the 5 years that the BDS campaign has been going than they could ever hope to do in the first 20 years. I mean, that this has gained so much momentum in Ireland, but also internationally, that, I mean, it's completely better, I guess, is the way I put it, than where they were 5 years into the anti-apartheid campaign. This, so, I mean, I think that's the reason to cheer for it, about the thing, absolutely. And yeah, it is problematic with the unions not really, as Freya said, slowly catching monkey type situation, but I mean, we're getting there, I think.
So maybe another round of questions, then we can go back to the break and shut then. Yes?
Yeah, about the people, about the risk, this is back about the flotilla again, people and resisting deportation from the Irish activists. Has any of the kind of, you know, more the politicians and kind of more famous people, have they Have any of them given their response, but what were they resisting deportation or, you know, because that's where things would really kick off media wise. If they're willing to do that.
Is there any other questions, and then we can set free to come in and ask them all together.
Can you say anything about, like, anti-Zionist or at least non-Zionist movements within Israeli politics, like specifically Israel?
Okay.
That's a question.
Okay, in terms of the politicians on board, I spoke to Angel Snuddy yesterday, and I think they were rotating who's got a turned on phone each day, and he was unsure. I mean, the problem at the moment is that a number of politicians from various countries were quite wary about them going from South Cyprus through to the north to board the boats, because it could kick off a huge diplomatic issue, basically. So the last time I actually spoke to them, they were very wary of, can we get on the, you know, should we go on these boats? Is this going to kick off something in Cyprus that's totally nothing to do with this? Are we better off just abandoning it? However, because they are more likely to grant a safe passage, the will is there to board the boats. Angus and Chris Andrews from Fianna Fáil, the good Fianna Fáil, the only one maybe, have both been on the Free Gaza boats before and have gotten into Gaza and luckily didn't actually face a situation where they had to deal with deportation. I asked Angus about it yesterday and what do you think you'll do, and they kind of said, look, you know, we kind of have to play it by ear. We're trying to deal with every eventuality, what might happen, but every day there's another eventuality, another possibility what could happen. So I mean, I suppose talking to three politicians, you're never going to get a straight answer. I didn't get a straight answer. I don't know. I think definitely what I was getting from them and from other people I've spoken to on the flotilla is they're going to try and reach consensus. How they're going to do that between 800 people and 7 different boats, I'm not sure. But they're going to try and work on a consensus-based principle, which would be ideal. However, as we saw with the Gaza Freedom March and the Viva Palestina convoy over the Christmas, that was very, very difficult as well, in that some people got into Gaza, others refused to go in because the entire march weren't being let in. I won't go into the issues. So, again, we're going to wait and see, but that would cause a huge PR disaster for Israel. So we're kind of hoping that they do, really. The other question then about anti-Zionist movements within Israel. As I mentioned before, to be explicitly anti-Zionist within Israel is actually illegal. Within the Israeli government, but there are quite a number of anti-Zionist NGOs. There are a number of left-wing progressive movements that aren't explicitly anti-Zionist, but they're getting there. And then some of the most openly, and I'm using militantly here in that they're organised, not that they carry guns, right? But militant or organised groups then would be groups like Anarchists Against the Wall, who are explicitly anti-Zionist. They suffer quite a lot because of this. I mean, they don't just deal with issues around Zionism and the occupation, but what I know them from and where I would have met them is, you know, resistance in Bilin, particularly Sheikh Jarrah, Hebron. Oftentimes, other people come with a very creative idea. It's not entirely, but direct action tends to come from them an awful lot of the time, and certainly the will is there with Palestinians and their own land has been robbed to get involved. These people then suffer, like, arrests and all the rest, but they are also, a lot of the anti-Zionist movements, especially Anarchists Against the Wall, are involved in social struggle causes within Israel as well, such as housing, single mother's rights. You know, the Mizrahi Jews tend to have a slightly harder time in terms of employment inequality and that kind of thing within Israel, so oftentimes their struggles will be taken up by groups like Anarchists Against the Wall. But, as I said, to be explicitly anti-Zionist within the Israeli government or within the Knesset is actually illegal. So even groups like the Balad Party and the Israeli Communist Party, they changed their name so many times. What?
Hadash.
Yeah. But they would have seats in the Knesset but are not in elected government. They run into difficulties. A lot of people are arrested, like Azmi Bashara. As a prime example of the Canadian exile, it is difficult to speak out and be vocally anti-Zionist, especially as a Palestinian citizen of Israel living within the state. So, Yeah, definitely something worth looking into, and a movement that we hope will grow, particularly for Israelis calling for BDS and calling for resistance to the occupation.
Hey, so, last
Has there been any major change in American policy towards Israel since Obama came to power?
Not really. You know, all this hope and change didn't really come to a lot. He came out at the beginning and made strong statements about, you know, halting settlement construction and the rest, while at the same time referring to Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which we all know it's not. Either the man is a fool, which I don't think he is, or he's clearly playing into the hands. The Israeli lobby in America is still as big and as powerful as ever. However, there is a slight shift, and not necessarily an official line, although, like I say, there's been strong statements made and absolutely no follow-through action. While they call for halt to settlement building, like, settlements are going up quicker than ever. They've actually increased in the last number of years at a faster pace than they had done before. Since Oslo, I mean, what is it, 16 years, 18 years in negotiation at this stage, and nothing, a worse situation for Palestinians. And that hasn't really changed since Obama came in. But there is a slight twinge of things happening there, in that Israel is starting to become a little bit of a thorn in the side for Palestine. My pronunciation.
Petraeus,
has made some statements which are, would show maybe a little twinge of hope. But to be honest, for the moment, I'm not incredibly optimistic that America is going to kind of create any kind of major push. I mean, even going back to the flotilla, it's a prime example of it. America is the one country that has the power to stop in and say, hang on, there's loads of American citizens on board these boats. If for nothing else, don't fire on this flotilla. Don't board it and arrest them all. Don't treat them as terrorists. These are, you know, humanitarian aid workers, or these are activists or humanitarians or whatever you want to call them. And it's completely disproportionate and, well, wrong, for want of a better word, for Israel to attempt to fire on this flotilla. America is the one country that has the power to step in and do something there. And given the huge amount of American citizens on board, they've a good enough excuse to do it if they're looking for one, and they haven't said a word. So, I don't know. We'll see if there's a shift, but I have to say, with all the hope for change and all the rest, I haven't seen it reflected in the Palestinian situation particularly yet. Well, this is okay.
In terms of the US-Israeli relationship, well, in regards to the lobby, I'm not convinced on that. But what I will say is that when you have far-right people like George Bush and Netanyahu in the two governments, there's a tendency to, like, just not ignore the Palestinians, but don't try and engage in process and negotiations and so on, which at least is honest, right? You can say that about Netanyahu. He says what he wants, and he does it. But when you have so-called dubs like Obama and Ehud Barak and all these kind of so-called peace camp people, right, that engage in endless processes of negotiations that, as Freya said, ended up with Palestine in an even worse state. During the Labour government in the 1990s, more settlements were built than at any time before. As far as, like, this is completely my own personal opinion, but negotiations are just a pretext for more exploitation and land grabs and so on, because it looks like something's happening, but nothing is. I mean, and everyone that's asked to give up things, it's always Palestinians that are asked to give up things. It's never Israelis. I mean, Palestinians, through the Oslo years, abided by almost every principle of the Oslo Accords. Israel didn't. And, I mean, to frame the struggle in terms of, well, can we get leaders talking to each other, I think it's a completely wrong-headed way of looking at it. And it is on the civil society, it is on the ground. That's where the real change will take place, in society. And, I mean, America does have a lot of power over Israel, but I don't see change for various geopolitical reasons. I mean, Israel suits America.
Okay, we leave there, we're just out of time. Just to remind people, there's stalls down in the hall downstairs. If you guess you have a stall down there, you can find more information. There's lots of other book stalls. At 2 o'clock, there is a talk coming up about revolutionary unions in Spain today. Quite different to the unions in this country. And then there's a series of other talks on, there's one about Iran on a 3, there's 4 past 3, there's revolutionary experiments in Ireland from 1917 to 2023. And just talk about the great gas and oil giveaway as well. And then there's a film from 4:30 to 6:00, which is a great film that we were going to see about drugs and against drugs. So, yeah, thanks very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frieda.
This audio is from the May 2010 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. You'll find more about the book fair, including more audio downloads, at www.wsm.ie/bookfair. This session was Israeli Apartheid, BDS and Grassroots Resistance in Palestine. The speaker is Frieda Hughes from the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. The audio was recorded and edited by Andrew Flood in June of 2010.